Ladies and gentlemen, happy Tuesday. Football Scoop Podcast is back. I'm back. These guys did it Sunday. I thought you guys did a fantastic job. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I watched a bunch of games on Saturday. Indiana beating Illinois that bad was just a pantsing. I thought Cignetti might go borderline erotic at postgame. It was deserving, and Brett would have been like, yeah, you're right. Brett would have tipped his cap to that. I'm one of those guys on the internet. You know, you go to like a website and it says like, hey, can we serve you ads based on your interests and stuff like that? And I'm always like, yeah, I want to see things that people that I should want to see. Twitter, Elon Musk buys it and figures it all out. And now he's got this For You page. So every now and then I go to the For You page. Last night about 9 o'clock, I opened the For You page. Hey, I wonder what Twitter thinks I should be interested in seeing. The very first thing is a Dan Mullen video. UNLV just went 4-0. They beat Miami of Ohio at Miami of Ohio. Last second field goal. They make theirs. Miami of Ohio drops a snap, doesn't get a chance. Anyway, whatever. UNLV's 4-0. They're on the plane. Dan picks up the phone and says, hey, guys, celebrate a big win. We got you a crumble cookie. And everyone's like, he's serious? Like, yeah. Are we supposed to clap? I don't know. Yay. Yeah. Okay, thanks. And Dan walks down the aisle and he's handing them boxes of cookies and they're like, this is awkward, coach. I don't know. So that happens. And the very next thing, Lane Kiffin's daughter apparently is dating an LSU player and chose to share that with the world the week they're playing LSU, which is just awesome. Oh, the SEC, it just means more. And some dude tweeted something like, this can only mean one thing. Bet the over. And Lane comes behind and goes, 100% bet the over. I'm like, Lane's a legend. Like, all I want from my coach is authenticity. And I'm not saying Lane's my guy. I'm just saying whoever you want your football coach to be, you want to be authentic. We've seen that a lot. Lane, God bless the man. Okay, good talk. I'm glad I could get that off of my chest. Gentlemen, how's everybody this morning?
Good. Yes, you got to be hip, Scott. What Landry Kiffin did was, quote, hard launch her dating relationship with linebacker Whit Weeks. She's not dating a scrub. So anyway, I love Lane for that. You're right. Authenticity should rule the day, which means all of us who have these websites or write for these websites shouldn't crucify a coach when he is authentic, because we're all here for it, and we race to see who can write the story the quickest when we get gold like that. So please keep giving us all of that.
1,000,000%. You know, guys, when I was thinking about this podcast briefly, I was thinking at the very end of the show, I might say something about Sean Clark, but JB, you mentioned it, authenticity. That's what should be shining a light on. Sean Clark died Monday night while in the hospital. And I really only spent significant time with him one time. It was at App State. I was up there visiting the program, and he just exuded. I spent some time with Scott Satterfield, who was the head coach at that time, and he's like, the guy you really should spend time with is Sean Clark. And he just loved the place, wanted to give me a tour, tell me all about it, tell me about like where he played, like how he played there and what he did. And he talked about his family. He loved to talk about his family. Just an authentic, great guy, great coach, in it for all the right reasons. Rest in peace, young man. To his family, we extend our prayers and our love and our condolences.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah.
And Scott, I mean, young man is a Scott Roussel phrase, but he's 50. When you're a kid, 50, the difference between 50 and 80 is – minuscule, but now the older you get, the younger 50 seems, and it's just incredibly tragic to lose him at age 50.
Yeah, I talked with coaches yesterday. I talked with coaches who had played for him, text with the Lamb family. Of course, you got Bobby, who's had a great career as a head coach at a number of different places. Taylor Lamb, the quarterback's coach at Virginia, played for Sean Clark at App State, was his quarterback when App State rolled into Neyland Stadium on a Thursday night and darn near beat a Vols team that was absolutely loaded with dudes like Josh Dobbs and Alvin Kamara and Jalen Hurd and Josh Malone and Derek Barnett and all the Jalen Reeves-Maven who's still in the league. And then I talked to another coach who remembered that Sean Clark was the first person – reach out and try to recruit him at Purdue. And we don't even associate, in my mind, we don't associate Sean Clark with Purdue. But here's a guy who immediately associated Sean Clark with recruiting him at Purdue. I think that tells you the type of genuine and authentic person that Sean Clark was.
Amen. Yes. All right. Yesterday, the CFL announced things like even taking out 10 yards of their field, and the whole world's like, I don't know. Okay. Also, the SEC is moving to the 9-game, conference stuff. ACC is doing the same. Any quick thoughts on that concept and where that's leading and why they're doing that? Zach?
I have some thoughts here. So obviously, once the SEC moved, then the ACC was the last one to play at 8 games. So they signaled immediately that this was coming. But I have some additional questions that, John, I'm hoping I can lean on you to answer. So obviously you have 17 teams. That's an odd number, I'm told. So you have to come up with a creative solution. And so what the ACC has decided is that 16 of the 17 are going to play 9 ACC games, and a 16th team is just going to play 8, and then that has to play 2 non-conference games against the Power Four. So I've seen speculation that could just be Clemson, and they only play 8, and everyone else plays 9 because Clemson has a 12-game annual home-and-home with Notre Dame coming up, and then obviously the annual game with South Carolina. I don't know if that's the case or if it's going to be a rotating team that every year it'll be different. And then, John, I'm curious for your take on this because the ACC also has a contract with Notre Dame where they play 5 ACC teams as well. So I'm kind of wondering why they didn't just say, all right, for the 5 teams that are going to play Notre Dame every year, we're just going to count that as a conference game. Obviously, Notre Dame's not joining, but we'll count that as a conference game. And then the other 12 can play 9 games. So I'm not surprised. Obviously, we all knew this was coming, but I leave the announcement with more questions than answers.
Yeah, and they're very valid questions, Zach. It's logical that that's how things would unfold, but I've learned, don't bring logic to an idiot fight. And so I don't think there's any way we can know that for sure at this point in time. But Notre Dame, I can tell you, views this as yet another assertion of its ability to stay completely independent, particularly with the 12-game Clemson series coming. They're also lined up to start playing Miami and Florida State much more frequently. So it could be, Zach, the combination of those 3 teams get their games against Notre Dame counted as ACC conference games, because specifically the ACC wants more Notre Dame inventory against those 3 teams. Notre Dame wants more inventory against those 3 teams to maintain its independence, but also to keep strength of scheduling a proponent that will keep it a factor in the college football playoff moving forward. So I'm with you. I have questions about it. Ultimately, I think this is a win for the Big Ten and the Big 12 in terms of they made those 2 conferences capitulate. And I know from people in the rooms in Destin in the last week of May, first week of June after Memorial Day, SEC coaches were dead set on keeping an 8-game conference slate because it just means more to play less. And instead now they're having to play that 9th game and that additional 10th game. I did think it was noteworthy that the ACC went out of its way to say we're now one of only 2 leagues committed to playing 10 power conference opponents every year. I do think that's noteworthy because we know you talk about Cignetti and the work that he's done at Indiana, but he's bought out of a Louisville game or a Louisville 2-year series and replaced them with FCS teams or patsies. And so now that the ACC and the SEC have done this, I wonder, will the Big Ten and the Big 12 keep their 9-game schedules and also adopt a similar you must schedule a quality power conference / Notre Dame opponent non-conference?
Zach, I appreciate you pointing out 17 is an odd number. Just quick show of hands. Who believes that 17 is a prime number? It's a prime number. Come on. Thank you. All right, we weren't. I don't know.
You do not.
Will there be no math?
You did not employ me for my math skills.
I was still not doing math. Thank you, Doug. Appreciate that.
I'm gonna echo what you said. I think there needs to be pressure on the Big Ten to match the SEC and ACC. Penn State's similar. I know they've played recent games against West Virginia and Pitt, but James Franklin is one of those. He's on the Signetti path that he wants to play as little resistance in his non-conference schedule as possible. That should not be tolerated moving forward. And then just the undercurrent of everything that's happening in the ACC is that basically Clemson, Florida State, Miami, they want as little to do with the Boston Colleges and the Stanfords as possible, as little games. They don't want to share. They want to take. Don't want to share money with them. They don't want to play them. But they're in the same conference because that's the arranged marriage that works best for them at this time. So I don't see that changing moving forward. And if it was up to Florida State and Clemson, they'd play four or five ACC games and then go and try and schedule Penn State and Tennessee and schools like that as often as they could.
All right. There might be a cash bonus on the line if you can answer this question. I was told there'd be no math. That is a famous line from a movie when I was growing up. If you can tell me the movie, the person who says it, and what he's doing in that particular time in the movie, the floor is open, gentlemen.
Somebody's.
Is it Animal House?
No.
No. Oh.
Spies Like Us, Chevy Chase, Spies yeah. Like Us. Come on, man. One of the great ones. Bye. I love you guys. Football savants, college football experts.
We watch film, football film, not Hollywood film.
Love you guys. Okay. There have been some coaching changes. Virginia Tech kind of tried to get the word out to every possible venue that, yeah, we made a coaching change, but we're about to pump in a lot more money. No, we didn't do it for Brent Pry, but now we're going to do it. No, really, we are. We're going to do it. We really are. Thoughts on how that tease from Virginia Tech plays in any way into that coaching search? Does it? Anybody thoughts?
I think that a lot of people have questions because Virginia Tech has lagged behind in finances, be it for simply having the program with top of the line facilities, top of the line nutrition, health and recovery, all of that stuff, to also being mid-pack or below in the ACC in terms of NIL and rev share. And let's be clear there, when we say mid-pack in the ACC, that means you're already way down the list because you're the ACC lags behind the Big Ten and the SEC in rev share and in NIL stuff. So I do think that that's Virginia Tech trying to send a message that we are serious. We know we have to step it up. We wrote about it a few weeks ago on Football Scoop when Whit Babcock went to their board of governors, I think it's called. It's not a board of trustees. It's like a board of governors, and said they needed to ratchet it up by about $200 million. And then I talked with some agents and some other people with direct knowledge of things at Virginia Tech. That $200 million represented about a $125 million gap. So they were somewhere in the $75 million range, which lets you know just how far they were lagging behind if $200 million is where they need to be to catch up. So, yeah, it's PR. It's trying to say, hey, we're going to make this a much more attractive job like it was when Frank Beamer had it rolling and they owned the Tidewater and recruiting and got the Michael Vicks and the other great players that came through there, Xavier Adebo and all of those guys.
So they've announced $222.9 million in new money through 2029. 120 of that is supposed to come from philanthropy. I wonder, who are these philanthropists and where did you find this $120 million and why were they sitting on the sidelines? They project an even $30 million per year, and then $39.6 million over the 4 years in bridge funding, $48.3 million in institutional support, and $21.3 million in student fee revenue. And Virginia Tech notes that that's $100 fee increase per year. VT is expected to continue to have the lowest comprehensive fee of the Virginia public institutions. And they include that, and I note that because Obviously, I expect there to be some blowback in Virginia Tech. I anticipated the blowback of you're raising student fees to either directly or indirectly put money directly into the pockets of athletes in a time where college is more expensive than ever and student loans are what they are. Now you're taking money out of the pockets of kids that are paying to go to school and then using that to fund the salaries of guys, of athletes that are largely already on scholarship. So I think that's something to just monitor here. I have additional questions, but yeah, I think Virginia Tech's clearly done the calculus that this is obviously expensive, but today's price is not yesterday's price. Tomorrow's price is not going to be today's price. And however expensive it is to win, it's even more expensive to lose.
For me, it's a huge red flag when your resources and your support don't match the administrative or fan expectations. And that's what Brent Pry dealt with during his time. They were bottom of the league in resources and funding. And that's a place with great tradition. The Inner Sandman coming out, one of the best traditions in college football. Great fan base, great recruiting base there in Virginia and the DMV not far away, that everyone is trying to get their hands in to bring dudes to. And he did not have the fan support the administrative support, the resources to compete at the level that he was expected to compete at and ultimately cost him his job. So with them upping all that, now they're going to, the talk is they're going to be in the same conversation as the Florida States and the Clemson. So the resources are going to match the expectations and that's going to attract some high quality guys.
Yeah, and I continue to believe, even though Virginia Tech sort of teetered somewhere as like a 7-8 win program, occasionally a 9-win program under Justin Fuente, and then haven't reached those 8-9 win standards under Brent Pry, I do still think that the perception out there is that you can go win at Virginia Tech. And I think the job will draw considerable interest because – you do have a natural recruiting base, and you are in the ACC, and it's at best the number three conference this year, probably the number four conference. And one thing we didn't touch on in our discussions about the expanded schedule to non-conference games now uniformly across the four power conferences, it almost certainly means by 27 we're going to have a 16-team playoff field at the latest.
I'm not saying he's the only guy that can do this job, but I wrote this in the coaching autopsy, and I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on this. Why wouldn't you just hire Bob Chesney? Like, talk me out of that.
Well, you got to convince Bob to take that job. That's the very first thing that comes to my mind.
I would also beg to ask, and I had mentioned this previously on a podcast a week or two ago, but. Like, is a job like Virginia Tech different because of the NIL landscape? The high academic institutions seem to be the ones that are struggling mightily right now. I know Cal just got whipped, but Stanford. The Stanfords, the Northwesterns, is that bargaining chip a lot lesser now when you've got, you can offer recruits big money, right? The college degree is one thing. Georgia Tech seems to be the one outlier right now this year that's doing really, really well at a high academic institution. But I think that becomes a major hurdle. And then do you want someone that has won at a high academic institution, someone that's on the job market right now, hungry for a job that, I think we're all thinking of?
I don't mean to cast aspersions on the fine institution here, but is Virginia Tech a high academic institution? That's a good. I don't think it's in the same class as the Stanfords and the Northwesterns.
Yeah, it's a good school. It's a good school. It's a state school. It's an engineering school. So it has that going for it. But it's still at the end of the day a state school, and that's significant because that allows you to do some things admissions wise that allows you to do some different things money wise. It also
changes your recruiting pool to something significantly smaller
in some regards, but I would contend it's not as narrow as Stanford, Northwestern, Notre Dame, any of those. Not at all. Not at all. I don't think it's close. To your point, Zach, about Chesney, that's a good one because he won at Holy Cross. So he knows winning at programs that have high standards academically and athletically. He also knows winning with lesser resources. I just think Chesney is going to have a pick of any number of jobs in this cycle if he wants to entertain those offers. And there'll probably be some that are more attractive than Virginia Tech that come open.
I don't think this is where you're going, Doug, but it went in my brain when you were saying all of that. Scott Abel coming from Davidson to Rice, just electrifying Rice, which is a very high academic. I don't want to say do more with less, but, you know, it's a very, very small school. Like, really, Rice is a tiny university. And bringing dudes in there who have to qualify to get in and winning because he's doing something a little different. Virginia Tech. Think about it.
That would be an enormous blow for Rice to lose him after 1 year. Could happen. I mean, not saying it's not going to happen. I'm just saying that would be an enormous blow for that program.
Well, James Madison is – I mean, if we're just dealing in reality here, James Madison could very much be on a third different head coach in 4 years if Chesney keeps those boys humming. And everyone I've talked to as we've worked on our series for Football Scoop, the conference intel, Chesney is a name that I hear consistently from agents. And again, agents that don't rep the dude are like, Bob Chesney's going to have options. So,
I think the other guy that deserves mention here that's on the market right now, hungry for a job, looking to get a sour taste out of his mouth, has been at a high academic institution, Pat Fitz. Like, to just go out there and freaking reel him in right now would be outstanding for Virginia Tech. I'd love to see him back in it. You get back to, you know, not to say anything about the other guys, but a super high character guy that is very well thought of in the profession and has dealt with some recruiting challenges in the past. And he's on the market right now. So,
and the advantage of getting him over anyone else is you hire him today, he can start working for you today and start putting a team together, putting a staff together and all that stuff. And I mean, if you wanted to get real about it, I mean, you could keep him off the books and he's not employed by anyone. So he could talk to whoever he wants about whatever he wants and you can fill in the blanks there. As you see fit.
I think, again, Pat is going to have several suitors. So that's a challenge. I mean, anyway, I think Jimbo Fisher would take the job today, like literally today.
Yeah, I think anyway, you're right.
What that's worth. All right, let's shift coasts. UCLA, you know, a lot of people are kind of negative on the leadership in UCLA, understandably.
Yep.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, they got to do something different. Martin Jarman is kind of in a place where he's like, I can't fail here. I got to go big. I can't really shift this onto the administration again. At some point, it becomes me. So I anticipate Martin is working to say, we have the resources. We're big boy committed. And I think they're going to go for a big-time hire is what I think. It's what I'm hearing. I'd just like your thoughts on UCLA football and the ability to attract that.
I think the first job, maybe even the only job, of whoever gets the UCLA job is you have to convince all the different constituencies, starting within your own building and your own university, of why UCLA football matters. I mean, you're playing – in Pasadena, and it's out of sight, out of mind. And I mean, it looked to me like there were about 9,000 people at that New Mexico game on a Friday night playing 2 hours from your camp, a 2 hour drive or whatever it is. And I wrote this half jokingly, half serious, but I think UCLA football, at least right now, is closer on the LA Los Angeles sports hierarchy. You're probably closer to Mine or Die than you are to the Lakers, the Dodgers, the Rams. Like, it's so easy to get lost there, and it's so easy to think, well, who really cares about UCLA football? We're a basketball school. We're a softball school, blah, blah, blah. So you have to convince the people, your donors, the people within your administration. You have to convince high school coaches, all of the above, why UCLA football matters. And if you can do that, and you get that right person that can do that, then I think that's 60% of the job right there.
I think UCLA, which is located in Los Angeles, for those of us wondering, it's as much a PR job at this point than it is a head coaching job. Like you're playing second fiddle to USC all the time in the same major metropolitan area. You've got to have a certain personality to come in there and handle that job, be able to recruit, and handle the PR that has come with the disaster that it's been so far. So it's got to be someone that's going to come in and completely rehab their image from the top down. And that's really only a handful of guys. Like there's going to be a lot of guys that are tossed around for this job, but there's only a handful of guys that are up to the billing of what UCLA requires in order to get it to a competitive level in the Big Ten.
Yeah, and I think that's really insightful from you, Doug, because it is we talked Sunday about Kirk Cignetti and that he was building IU football, not rebuilding IU football. And in my opinion, UCLA in such short order has sunken to a level that it's more of a complete new build than a rebuild. I mean, it's bad. And coaches, unsolicited, I've had coaches text me in recent days and just be like, by the way, UCLA is really bad. Stanford is really bad. Those two programs have immense, immense work to do. And they also have the external factors that you guys have very, very well outlined here about the apathy isn't just from the fan bases at those two schools. The apathy is in the ivory towers at Stanford and UCLA. And you're going to have to convince candidates that the apathy is changing or that the buy-in is already there and the public just doesn't realize it. Like with Virginia Tech, Virginia Tech's handling all of this so much better than UCLA or Stanford because Virginia Tech's letting it be known. We're getting new money. We care about football. We want to reclaim our stake as a football school. We want to continue to give our fans and alumni something to be proud of on the football field, and that'll help our university grow. We don't hear those messages from UCLA or Stanford.
I'm glad you brought up Stanford, John, because I said this on the pod, and it applies to UCLA as well, and those schools are in the same boat, literally and figuratively, is that Stanford's arguably the top institution in this country. UCLA is arguably the top public school in this country, I guess second to Cal, whatever. They're great in every other sport that they do. So if I'm the head coach of either of those institutions and I'm talking to the academic side, or I'm like, my argument is we are the elite of the elite in every single thing that we do, from tennis to rowing to microbiology. We're elite in everything except football. And like it or not, more people interact with our brand through football than they do through microbiology and you name it. So if we are elite and we have a state, why do we tolerate our most important division within this global university to be so bad? Why is that acceptable? Why are we just throwing football, say, we're great in everything else? We're great in everything. So why is football treated differently? And then the difference between UCLA and Stanford and Virginia Tech and Indiana is that there's the problem that no one can solve, and that is you're playing 3,000 miles and two or three time zones away from the rest of your conference. And I know Oregon, Washington, USC are in those, but there's a different institutional hunger to win at those schools than there is at UCLA and Stanford.
Zach, I'm glad you brought up the admissions part and things like that, because I've talked to some now this is small level coaches, but coaches at like MIT and institutions like that. UCLA, like the football and basketball programs are the front porch of your school. Like they are the forward facing, what everyone sees, right? But when you talk to coaches at a smaller school that have high academic standards, the admissions department's feeling towards them is we don't need you. Well, that can't be the same at UCLA. Like you absolutely need us. But that just goes to show the two different lines of thought. The admissions in school are like, yeah, we're excellent in everything, but we don't necessarily need football because we're excellent at everything else. And that can't be the stance at UCLA.
This is what the athletic director's job is.
And we say it's harder to win now than ever, yada, yada, yada. Indiana, Vanderbilt, Georgia Tech are all in the top 25 right now.
They've done it. Yep.
They hired the right coach.
Well, yes. And Vanderbilt's the only one of those three schools that gave the head coach a long enough time to actually build the program. Now they've taken the next step because they got a transfer who's proved transcendent in Diego Pavia. But Vanderbilt had to initially exercise great patience with Clark Lee. Let's not forget, they got hammered at home early, either year one or year two, by ETSU, an FCS program. And they beat them like 24-6 in Nashville. And Vanderbilt stadium real quickly looked even more deserted than the Rose Bowl. And, Zach, you're right. I don't think there's any question that Mater D has more passionate fans right now than UCLA, and it's not close.
So a couple things. Clark Lee, good football coach, hunt. Hiring Jerry Kill is what changed our program. If you don't hire Jerry Kill, you don't get Diego Pavia, but you also don't get Jerry Kill. Jerry Kill is what changed Vanderbilt football. Repeat after me, guys. Modern day. Modern day. Modern day.
Modern day.
Zach's brought this up in like three different podcasts and says it differently every time, and I enjoy it.
I was told there'd be no pronunciation guides in today's podcast.
We're going to be sharing some videos after this one. You guys are amazing. One last thing I'll mention on UCLA is a $5 million salary for a head coach at Virginia Tech. That human and his family live like kings. Mm-hmm. In Los Angeles, $5 million in Virginia Tech terms, it's like $800,000. It's just a different world. You gotta get to $9 or $10 million just to live a normal LA life, which is insane for me to say that. But the taxes and the cost of living are just brutal. So, and that's the thing in coaches' minds. Coaches and agents are very aware of these things. So,
yeah, you got it.
There's one candidate that just got a $100-something+ million settlement. So that should help.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right, though. You've got to get way up there. If you're at $8 million, you better be given housing as well. Like, you better have a nice house to take care of things, which is USC, to its credit, was very creative in providing housing for Lincoln Riley and helping some of the other coaches with housing, some of the other important support staff, upper level personnel people. So yeah, you've got to be creative in that. That's another element that also will let a potential coach know, okay, they're serious. Like, they're doing what it takes. They're committed.
Amen. We could talk about some other changes. We're 33 minutes into this thing. Why don't we hold some other potential talk maybe for Thursday or something like that? By the way, there's some really fun football happening this upcoming Saturday. On Thursday, we're going to talk about those games that are coming. We might pay homage to Zach, who continues to lead the picks. Are you guys trying? Is there something?
We call it.
I want it to be known that at this point, with a 3-game lead, I could be the last one. Oh, who's John like? Who's Scott like? Okay, I'll go with them. Or I could just coast this thing out and just pick the same as them so that no matter what, we'd have the same record. I enter my picks first.
That's soft.
So there's no drafting here. This lead is earned.
Yeah, that would – I mean, why should you even say that out loud? That's just saying that, like, you don't really want to compete.
That's like, and you've considered that? Like, that just,
I'm just saying, awful. Other people that have won in the past had the opportunity to do that. I don't know if they have or not, but I'm saying I'm not doing that.
This guy's running to the sideline and then staying on the field for a play.
Talked about it in the pregame, didn't they? Ain't that something? Ain't that something? Hey, Hugh, it's Greg Sankey. Man, I feel bad. Y'all got jobbed. I really feel bad. Just wanted you to know, I feel bad that our refs really jobbed y'all. What?
Yeah.
SEC, bro. Come on.
There'll be appropriate action. We're just not going to know about it, you know, because we hold everyone accountable, and we publicize every time we fine a school $500,000 for its great fans celebrating, but we're not going to speak to the sacred.
Good stuff.
Ridiculous.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's make it a great week. God loves you guys. We're out. Peace.